The FM Kicks band brings jazz to area parks. August 1st, 6:30 p.m., Hanson Arts Park in Jamestown. August 3rd, 10 a.m., Red River Market in Fargo. August 4th, noon to 5, FM Kicks Band Jazz Festival, Gooseberry Park. Details at fmkicksband.com. The Kicks Band receives funding from the Arts Partnership with support from the cities of Fargo, Moorhead, and West Fargo.
Welcome to this Thursday edition of Main Street. I'm your host, Craig Blumenschein. In the second half of today's show, our longtime friend, Dr. Tom Easern, shares another of his Plains Folk essays. This one's titled, Things Made of Words. He'll describe a trip he made with his students last spring to Ashley to pilot the first cloud cataloging project of a museum in North Dakota. It was a transforming experience for many of his students, and we'll learn more. Madeline will review the slasher movie Long Legs, and Dave Thompson and I will revisit this week's news. But first, we'll chat with author Kevin Fidarko about his new book, Walk in the Park. The book recounts the author's and his friend Pete McBride's attempt to traverse the Grand Canyon on foot, a journey fraught with unexpected challenges and revelations. Kevin, welcome to Main Street.
Thanks so much for having me.
I want to begin, I think, by asking you who Colin Fletcher was.
Colin Fletcher is referred to by people who know him as the godfather of backpacking. Born in Wales, came to the United States, and in the summer of 1963, undertook a remarkable journey, which involved traversing with a backpack on foot the length of what was at the time Grand Canyon National Park. During those years, the borders of Grand Canyon National Park embraced only about a little more than a third of Grand Canyon itself. But he wrote a book, the title of which is The Man Who Walked Through Time. Fletcher's account of the landscape he traversed, the experiences that he underwent inside of that abyss, they were all contained in the pages of this book, but one of the most prominent and, for me, salient features of it was a photograph he took of himself that was emblazoned on the cover. It captures him standing with his back to the viewer, backpack on his back, a stout walking stick in his hand, gazing across this ocean of bare naked rock, this giant hole in the ground with a very thin blue ribbon of water running along its bottom. And my father, back in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, handed me a copy of that book when I was 10 or 11 years old. The image itself transfixed me, planted a seed in my mind, and I determined at some point after picking it up for the first time that I was going to have to find a way to get from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania to the Grand Canyon.
How did you then decide to, with your friend Pete, to walk through the park?
Well, that's a story that really begins in the early 2000s when I went to the Grand Canyon for the very first time. I was enrolled in what was called a Wilderness First Responder course, which is designed to impart the rudiments of emergency backcountry medicine, which I felt I needed at the time because I was working as a freelance magazine writer and traveling all over the world to some rather exotic and remote places. And I walked into a boathouse in Flagstaff, Arizona, and my jaw just hit the floor. I found myself staring at this diminutive navy of small wooden rowboats known as Grand Canyon dories. And something about those boats, the simplicity, the austerity, the beauty of their lines, the bright colors they were painted in that made them look like floating Easter eggs, the paintings that were affixed to their transoms depicting birds and animals of the desert Southwest, all of that crystallized in my mind. I was determined to find a way to follow those boats into the hidden world of whitewater at the bottom of the Grand Canyon. I did so. I spent the better part of six seasons struggling as an apprentice river guide, discovered a story there about three river guides who put a little wooden dory into the Colorado River in the spring of 1983 and used a historic flood as a kind of hydraulic slingshot to propel them through the canyon faster than anyone had done in history. Wrote a book called The Emerald Mile that chronicles that world. And then in the summer of 2015, shortly after that book was published, My good friend and collaborator, Peter McBride, a National Geographic photographer and filmmaker, came to me with a rather harebrained idea. And he said, look, I know that you are familiar with the world of whitewater at the bottom of the Grand Canyon, but what we're going to do is an assignment for National Geographic. We are going to strap 55-pound backpacks on our backs, and we're going to walk from one end of Grand Canyon National Park to the other, despite the fact that there's no trail. And that's how this project originated.
What were you thinking when he brought that idea to you?
I was thinking two things. The first, and the one that I should have stuck with, was this is absolutely crazy and no way am I going to do this. The best and easiest and most enjoyable way to traverse the canyon is to follow the only highway that makes any sense, the Colorado River, the instrument that carved and created and polished and sculpted the canyon in the first place, and that affords a marvelous way to move through the landscape by allowing you to pilot boats through it. And so, but at the same moment, you know, I was aware of something that Pete knew about too. The central character in the book that I had written, the man who originated the idea of conducting this speed run in a little wooden dory through the Grand Canyon, a book called The Emerald Mile, his name was Kenton Grua. And in the spring of 1983, as I mentioned, they set this historic speed record. But 5 years prior to that, Kenton Grua had done something that arguably was much more difficult and a much more important achievement. He had figured out how to become the first person in modern recorded history to walk through the Grand Canyon. And Pete knew that despite how crazy the idea was, I would find it irresistible to literally follow in the footsteps of this man who I had written one book about, but whose true achievement remains something of a mystery to me.
Grand Canyon, of course, incredible natural history, and that's really a significant part of your narrative. What are some surprising facts that you discovered, A, in your research, but B, in your experience?
Here are two things that are kind of interesting. The first, and this will give you an idea of how broken and convoluted the landscape inside the canyon actually is. The Colorado River, which I just mentioned a moment ago, that river travels 277 miles as it moves from the eastern gateway at the head of Grand Canyon, a place known as Lee's Ferry, all the way to the Grand Wash Cliffs, which form the canyon's western terminus. If you were on foot moving through that landscape, traveling through the canyon in a linear fashion, you will spend so much time and so many miles moving up and down the walls of the canyon, piecing together a route that will enable you to traverse often very, very thin cliff ledges and terraces. And you will spend so many miles taking mandatory detours into what we call side canyons, tributary canyons that extend off of both sides of the main stem canyon, more than 600 of them. You'll spend so much time embarked on these kind of detours that you will traverse not 277 miles, but 750 miles. And the walls of the canyon, these are mile-high ramparts of rock comprised of terraces and cliffs that extend from the edges of the Colorado River to the rims of the canyon. There's 6,000 feet of vertical distance. There's so much temperature gradient between the tops of the canyon and the bottom of the canyon that the life forms that proliferate at the rims of the canyon, particularly the North Rim, the highest point in the canyon, 6,000 feet above the Colorado River. This is an environment that's a subalpine environment. You'll find aspen trees and conifers like Douglas firs. You'll find rough grouse and black bear and meadows filled with wildflowers in the summertime. And as you move down the walls of the canyon, as the air becomes hotter and water becomes more scarce, you move through a succession of ecozones until you find yourself at the bottom surrounded by vegetation and animals that populate the Sonoran Desert. You will traverse such a range of flora and fauna that you will journey from what is the equivalent of the types of plants and animals that you would see in central Canada to the types of plants and animals that you would see in northern Mexico. And what the canyon does is it takes those 2,000 miles of linear distance, flips it vertically, and compresses it into a single vertical mile, and then compresses all of the life forms and ecosystems that you find across that 2,000-mile distance into the canyon itself. It's a remarkable landscape. There's no place like it, and it's the single most iconic national park in America because of that.
We're enjoying our conversation with Kevin Fedarko. He's written a new book, A Walk in the Park. It's a compelling narrative that intertwines adventure, humor, and the harsh realities of the natural world. It recounts he and his friend Pete McBride's attempt to traverse the Grand Canyon on foot, a journey fraught with unexpected challenges and revelations. Let's talk about the challenges first. Humorous ones we read about, cactus, anthills. I'm sure there are many others.
Yes, there are. I have to say that I'm embarrassed, but it's the truth and I can't pretend otherwise. Pete and I thought we knew what we were getting into. I mean, I'd written an entire book in the bottom of the canyon. I figured how hard could it actually be? And we did not prepare adequately for our journey. We didn't bring the right gear. We weren't in the type of physical shape that we needed to be in. We had not done a very good job figuring out what our route was going to be. And as a result, we suffered terribly, particularly during the first of what would turn out to be 8 back-to-back expeditions inside the canyon. We started out in the fall of 2015 amidst a very substantial late summer, early autumn heat wave in which the temperatures were around between 105 and 110 degrees at night. Within a couple of days, my feet were covered in so many blisters, it looked as if I'd been given a pedicure with a belt sander. And Pete had succumbed to a heat-related condition, very serious condition called hyponatremia, resulting from a deficiency of electrolytes that can, if you're not careful, kill you. And so that marked the beginning of what turned out to be a litany of hardship and suffering that accompanied us from our first steps to our last steps inside the canyon, but was also punctuated by moments of wonder and revelation and epiphany and magic.
And I assume it's all of that, the wonder, the epiphany, the magic that kept you coming back for more, so to speak.
It did. The canyon has a way, as many powerful landscape features do, as I assume there are landscape features in your part of the world to which people become affixed. The canyon has a way of sinking its teeth and its claws into you and refusing to let go. And once you find yourself in its grasp, despite the punishment that it is capable of administering, the gifts that it offers up, both in terms of experience and insight, are so powerful and compelling that you find yourself continuously coming back for more.
Kevin, you wrote about the emotional experience of seeing your dad undergo chemotherapy and how it deeply impacted you. Can you elaborate on how witnessing his journey maybe influenced your own personal and emotional journey when you were on this incredible expedition?
I don't think I really fully understood this when Pete and I started our walk, but as I began to write the book, I realized that my journey through the canyon did not begin at Lee's Ferry, the Eastern Gateway to Grand Canyon, where we started walking. It began back in Pittsburgh when I was 10 years old, and my father handed me that copy of Colin Fletcher's book that you asked me about a moment ago, and the seed that that planted in my mind. And in some ways, I think my journey to the canyon and then through the canyon represented a kind of affirmation and completion of dreams that my father, I think, had about experiencing natural beauty, about going to some of the great landscapes of the American West, and that he was never able to do. It's terribly sad, but you know, my dad had been diagnosed with cancer, the cancer that eventually would kill him, just before I began my journey through the Grand Canyon. And he was only able to follow that journey in the form of conversations and phone calls and photographs that I shared with him. But the knowledge of my connection to him and his interest and the fact that I was completing a dream that was not only mine but his, that was part of the baggage that I carried with me inside my backpack, along with my camp stove and my sleeping bag and the dehydrated food that Pete and I were eating for dinner each and every night. I wasn't aware of the fact that it was there until I started writing the story. And one of the most salient aspects of the whole thing is that, you know, one of my goals when we completed this journey was to finish this book, to write fast enough that my dad would be able to hold the book in his hands and read it before he passed away. And I couldn't do that. I couldn't write faster than my father's death. It took me 7 years to write this book, but my great friend Pete, he was able to complete a coffee table photograph book.
He is a great photographer, by the way.
He's a marvelous photographer and a very, very gifted filmmaker as well. And he did a documentary film called Into the Canyon and this coffee table book called Between the River and the Rims. And my father was able to hold his book, Pete's book, in his hands, sitting in front of the fireplace, and page through the best of the images that Pete took during the entire year that Pete and I spent inside the canyon, and relive that experience, thanks to Pete, on the final Christmas before he died.
Tell me more about your friendship with Pete. You are going through an incredible, physically and emotionally demanding journey that has many ups and many downs as well. Oftentimes, those kinds of relationships don't survive that kind of pressure, if you will. Tell me about how your friendship with Pete's evolved and has evolved, especially post-expedition until today even.
I mean, Pete and I have a very odd and interesting connection, and our relationship has both devolved and evolved over the years. You know, we've worked together for the better part of the past 20 years. We've gone on magazine assignments to some rather exotic and remote parts of the world, places like the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, the Caucasus Mountains, the Horn of Africa, Everest Base Camp. Each and every one of those assignments wound up being a kind of a disaster, a debacle in one form or the other, largely because Pete had thought these ideas up without really kind of doing his homework, and because the two of us did not do enough preparation. And so we have a history of moving into and getting in over our heads. And we did that many times before this project in the Grand Canyon. And I think in some ways, it set up a theme that was very familiar to us as we struggled across the arc of that summit 150-mile journey inside the canyon. But it also meant that Pete and I, by the time we embarked on our misadventure in the canyon, had been through a great deal together, and we knew that despite how much trouble we might get ourselves into, despite the mistakes that we might commit both separately and together, that each of us could rely absolutely and completely on the other. Our trust in one another was complete, and it remains so to this day. Arduous, gorgeous, natural landscapes, public lands, national parks, national monuments, they have a way of both testing and strengthening the bonds between people when they go into these places together. And that is one reason why I feel very strongly at the end of this journey that although so many of us think of experiencing nature as something that we do in a solitary manner, particularly if we've read writers like Henry David Thoreau or Edward Abbey or John Muir, most Americans experience our greatest natural wonders as a communal experience. We do it with the people we love. We do it with our families. And we come out of those places better and closer than when we went into them because of that.
Is that the message you want readers to take away from your experience and your writing of A Walk in the Park?
That's one of two messages I'd like to take them to take away. The other is that, Craig, it's not necessary to strap a giant pack on your back and spend more than a year stumbling through the most inaccessible reaches of a place like Grand Canyon to touch or be touched by the wonders of this national park or any of our national parks. The writer Wallace Stegner once said that part of the power of wilderness and part of the reason why it is incumbent on us as Americans to preserve and protect it and pass it along intact to future generations, to our children and our children's children, is that part of its power resides in the fact that you don't necessarily have to move into the heart of wilderness to be affected by it. Sometimes it is enough simply to step to the edge and look in. Sometimes it's enough simply to know that it's there. And there are 6 million people each and every year who drive into the main entrance of Grand Canyon National Park, who do not hike, who do not boat, who don't ride mules down to the canyon. They simply stand along the rim. They find a place that's quiet. They watch the sunrise. They watch the sunset. They take in the silence and the stillness of all of that rock and all of that air and all of that light, and they walk away changed in some way. And that experience is available to each and every person who takes the trouble to simply visit our national parks.
Very well that you encourage folks to do that. I grew up just about an hour and a half away from Grand Teton and Yellowstone National Park. and had many of those experiences, certainly that you're just talking about there. Kevin, before we go, the Grand Canyon has rich human history as well. And did learning stories of those who came before you there influence your journey and your writing?
Absolutely. And I realize I'm remiss because there's not two things I'd like to take readers away. There are three, and okay. you're touching on the third. I'm embarrassed to say that when I went into the canyon with Pete, I was unaware of the importance and the richness of stories of people who are connected to this landscape, whose relationship to it far predates that of people like myself, who are the descendants of white settlers who populated the American West in the 19th century. Prior to the time in which we set aside this canyon and declared it to be a national park and put a fence up around it to protect it from incursion, from development, from ruination, it was populated by people who considered that their home and who had lived there not just for hundreds, but for thousands of years. There are 11 Native American tribes whose ancestral lands either abut or lie directly inside of what is now Grand Canyon National Park. And part of the myth that we tell ourselves as Americans about our national parks is that we demonstrated the sagacity and the wisdom as a society to recognize these places of great natural beauty and set them aside and preserve them for future generations of Americans. But we neglect to mention, we tell ourselves a lie about the fact that when we set these places aside, we had to exile the people who considered it their home and were there already. And those people are not only an important and an essential part of the past in these landscapes, but they're very much a part of the present and the future. Those 11 Native American tribes, their reservations still lie on the periphery of the national park. The wisdom, the knowledge, the connection that they have to the landscape itself is encoded in their language, their culture, and their traditions. The relationship they have with it remains intact, alive, and vital. They continue not just to simply tell stories about it, but to go into the park to perform rituals and ceremonies, to tell their children about it. And an awareness of these people, their presence on the land, their knowledge of it, the history to which they've been subjected, the injustices that have been done to them, all of these are like the existing layers of rock. They add another layer of richness and meaning and insight and challenge and provocation on top of the land itself. And therefore, it's an essential part of experiencing this landscape to learn about these people and to familiarize oneself, as I failed to do initially and came to do eventually, with their stories.
Kevin, you've been a senior editor at Outside Magazine. Your writings have appeared in such places like Esquire, National Geographic Adventure, and the New York Times. What's next?
A really long hiatus. I was 50 years old when I completed the walk through the park with Pete McBride. At the time, I didn't think anything could be more brutal or difficult than making our way on foot through the canyon. And then I spent 7 years writing this book, which was even harder than the journey itself. And I made a lot of sacrifices, as many, many writers do. Time stolen from the people I love, from my family, from my wife, from my kids. And I need to spend time with them. I need to reconnect with them. And I need to allow the book to make its own way through the world so that people can judge for themselves what they think of it, whether it has value, and what it might have to offer.
Kevin Fedarko, he's written A Walk in the Park. It's more than a tale of adventure. It's really a story of resilience and the power of nature and the indomitable human spirit. It truly is thought-provoking, and I believe it offers readers a glimpse into the profound impact, like Kevin talked about places like the Grand Canyon. Kevin, best wishes.
Craig, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for your conversation and your questions.
Thanks for joining us on Main Street. More Main Street is ahead. Stay with us.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Josh Beauchet, broker and realtor with Real Broker LLC. With a team of agents serving homebuyers, sellers, and investors throughout North Dakota, the Detroit Lakes area, and Northwest Minnesota. Josh can be reached at 701-367-3513.
Coming after the break, Tom Ezern, Madeline, and Dave Thompson. Stay with us.
Support for Bray Public is provided by Bill Dean, Realtor with Better Homes and Gardens Real Estate Alliance Group of Bismarck, specializing in helping new and established investors hit their goals from single family to commercial investing. Information can be found at BillDeanHomes.com.
Welcome back to Main Street on this Thursday. I'm your host, Craig Blumenschein. In just a bit, Madeline and I will review the movie Long Legs, and Dave Thompson and I will discuss this week's news. But first, our longtime good friend, Tom Ezern, shares his newest Plainsfolk essay, Things Made of Words. So many stories to tell, he writes, we should do it well.
The hospitality was great when I took a gang of students to Ashley last spring to pilot the first cloud cataloging project in a local museum in North Dakota. Our main hosts were Marvel Gross and Randy Wall of the McIntosh County Heritage Center, which has fabulous collections. The Ashley Lions Club and the McIntosh County Bank were generous in financial support, enabling us to eat well and to lodge in a fascinating heritage establishment, the Ashley Lodge. We enjoyed meals at the Prairie Rose, breakfasted on those great sausage sandwiches from Ashley Super Value, and had unlimited supplies of Coogan, courtesy of Grandma's Coogan. The transforming experience began not long after we departed Fargo, for most of the students were Minnesotans who had never been west of I-29. For a while, they reckoned we were about to fall off the edge of the earth. They perked up when we climbed onto the coteau and then marveled as we entered a snow globe of migrating geese. The truly transformative experience was the encounter with the artifacts at the MAC. The literature on Generation Z says that Zoomers, first of all, are comfortable with matters digital, which was important. We came to the Heritage Center to enter its collections into a digital system. Zoomers also, and I know it seems discrepant, they are taken with tangible things. Fortune magazine says the reason they like music on vinyl is they are drawn to all things touchable. And here they were, encouraged to pick things up, hundreds of things, examine them, get to know them, figure them out. The match of the task at hand with generational aptitudes, I think, was what made the project a success. No one predicted how readily the students would engage the artifacts. Now I am doing data cleanup, making their notes into a functional catalog, and realizing that expression in writing, however, is not my students' strong suit. As I think about this, I happen to be reading an old classic in the practice of everyday history, the 1982 book called Nearby History by Kivig and Marty. This is helpful. For the past generation, we have been trying to expand the menu of learning, to embrace the graphic and the oral and the interactive. Perhaps we have neglected written expression. I don't mean anything so prosaic as so-called communication skills. I mean the ability to engage, compose, make sense, and put things into words to tell a story. When I say this, remember, I speak as a self-conscious person of letters, but Kivig and Marty confirm historians tell stories. They investigate origins by putting things into words. Local history begins as a matter of the senses, that tangible thing the Zoomers love, but it proceeds to expanding the powers of perception and then putting things into words. Kivig and Marty say, if artifacts are to be more than merely perceived and appreciated, they must be understood in words. That is, handled conceptually. Maybe I haven't taught this part well. I'm going to do better hereafter, so that when one of my students encounters a wicker trunk with leather handles that came over from the old country, she will want to get to know Henry Huber, the strapping farmer who came from Saratov via Liverpool on the steamship Dynamometer, married and farmed and became a U.S. citizen and raised a family in McIntosh County, but held on to this wicker trunk, took care of it, so that when his family presented it to the Historical Society, it remained in excellent condition. So many stories to tell. How fortunate we are. We should do it well.
That was our good friend Tom Ezern with his Plains Folk essay. Dr. Ezern is a distinguished professor of history at North Dakota State University. Dave Thompson and I will review the news. That's next.
Extra, extra, read all about it. Gather round, everybody.
Stories, stories, stories. Each and every week we review the news with Prairie Public's news director, Dave Thompson. Dave, how are you?
I'm doing fine, Craig. How are you?
I'm doing very well, Dave. The farther you go west in our state here in the next day or two, oh my gosh, is it going to be hot?
Yeah, we're talking temperatures in the hundreds, and then you add humidity to that, and then you add smoke from the wildfires, and it's going to be a little uncomfortable.
Uncomfortable might be a kind word, Dave.
Probably.
Oh my goodness. Lots to talk about in the news, but I want to lead off with something fun. You wrote a story about Bismarck Water Tower, which you've looked at for a long time. It'd be torn down.
It is being torn down. It's 107 foot. It's blue in the northern part of the city, just off Washington Street. I used to pass it a lot during me growing up in Bismarck and also the drive to work. And it was constructed back in 1938, decommissioned after 65 years of service. It was built when that was basically the north end of the town. The north goes quite a bit further. And so they had a west end reservoir and that, which provided the community with drinking water, service, and storage. Cities expanded. They've got other ways to store water. The water tower became kind of superfluous. And now it is going to be sold for scrap.
How are they going to tear it down, Dave? I have this vision of dynamite going off and the whole thing crashing down, but I have a feeling it won't be that way.
No, what the construction crew told me they're going to do, there's a bowl, of course. It's being held by a bowl, and then there are legs holding the bowl.
Mm-hmm.
They're taking the bowl down. They're kind of working on deinflating, if you want to put it away, a metal bowl. And I saw that work, and that's really interesting how they did that. Then they take the bowl off, and they cut that into pieces for scrap. Then they take the four legs off and then cut those pieces into scrap.
Down goes a piece of history.
Yes.
Although I should say the Historical Society didn't feel it worthy of being left in place, correct?
Right, that's correct. And also a neighborhood association ponied up $150,000 to buy the lot, and they're trying to develop two or three new houses on that lot. So it might be a win-win, but it's a little nostalgic.
Dave, North Dakota lost a good one. Grand Forks former mayor Pat Owens passed away. She was 83.
Right. And she was known as the flood mayor because she guided the community through its worst disaster in its history. Now, when I worked in Grand Forks at a radio station up there, I used to talk with Pat Owens quite a bit because City Beat was one of my beats. And she was like executive assistant to the mayor. So we had some very good conversations, and I was in touch with her as the floodwaters were starting to rise in Grand Forks. And I know that that was a very difficult time for the entire city. As a matter of fact, she was quoted as saying that when they came to her and said, you have a choice of evacuating the city, she thought about it for a while because what happened if there was no flood? She would probably get a lot of heck for it. But she signed the evacuation orders and you know what happened, basically.
How did she really help the city recover, Dave? What do you remember about that?
Well, she got President Bill Clinton involved. Clinton came out and visited the area and promised his help to Pat Owens. And as the city recovered, she worked with President Clinton to get federal money in to help and to, you know, pull the community up by its bootstraps. The unfortunate thing is she only served one term as mayor and was defeated basically in the year 2000.
Was this the genesis then of the diversion project, Dave? And did she have a hand in that, or did that come after her time in office?
It came after her time in office, but the project they had for the flood walls was during her time in office. The diversion, of course, came later, but they have a great system now to protect the cities, Grand Forks and East Grand Forks, from flooding. And that's one of her legacies.
They have a University of North Dakota professor has kind of weighed in now on President Biden's decision to end his reelection campaign. You wrote a story about that.
I certainly did. And just as a starting off point, I happened to be in the office when got the notification via email that President Biden was not going to run for reelection. I broke on the air, you know, and said, stay tuned, NPR will have more. Didn't know about special coverage. So when we were back in special coverage during one of the breaks, I just happened to catch him at home because I have a cell number. So I called him and said, well, you've heard about it. He said, yeah. So what do you think about it? And then he came right away and says, this was a coup by the donor class, because it was the donor class who was saying they're going to withhold some of their donations to the Biden-Harris campaign if Biden was still on the ticket.
Once the money train ended, something needed to be done, essentially, is what he was advocating.
That is actually correct, yes.
Dave, an attorney for North Dakota, now has asked a judge to dismiss a lawsuit over the state's abortion ban. What's new there?
Now, this is an interesting case because I remember when it was first argued, the state passed an abortion ban at 6 weeks. This group that wanted to sue about that took a case to court saying that there's at least an inherent, or maybe not, you know, inherent, but a right to abortion because right to health care is in the North Dakota Constitution. Well, a judge denied that, and now there was a trial scheduled. But now the state, which is the plaintiffs, they're arguing that the plaintiffs are wrongfully bringing their case based on hypothetical and not facts. They're talking about something that might happen in the future. Now, remember, North Dakota had one abortion clinic, and that was in Fargo. It moved across the river to Minnesota. So they say that there's no factual basis on this. This is hypotheticals. I think this is going to be an interesting when Judge Romanek issues a decision on this.
Dave, is there any new fallout from Dickinson State University President Stephen Easton's resignation that you have to report?
Not that I have to report, but I've got a couple things working on it. Number one, I need to understand, and I'm trying to get a hold of this, how Mayville State University is going to actually help take over that program at DSU. That's happening, but I'd like to know a little bit more of the, you know, what's actually happening, where do students go, who is going to be granting the degrees when they graduate from this nursing program. There's a lot of unanswered questions.
Sure. I mean, the nurse instructors all in unison resigned.
Right, because they were concerned that what the DSU president was putting down in terms of staffing per student, student staffing, et cetera, it was not going to meet accreditation standards. And apparently it came to loggerheads and the entire faculty just resigned. I think that's just, and I have to say this, there's been some unrest at Dickinson State University for a while, and this was kind of a manifestation of that.
I think there are dozens and dozens, maybe up to 100 students involved waiting now to see what will happen with that nursing program.
I'm sure they have a lot of questions too, and I think there needs to be some place where some of these questions are answered. I'm not saying that it's a bad thing or a good thing. I just think there are questions that need to be answered.
Sure. Dave, what are you working on? What are we going to hear from you in the coming week?
Well, what's interesting is I've got this story about a new program that law enforcement has embraced in North Dakota. They got iPads from a group called ABIL-E. And ABIL-E basically will connect somebody who may be arrested and might have some mental issues to a mental health provider using this iPad, and it prevents more arrests and gets people treatment faster.
Gather round, everybody.
Dave, thanks for visiting with us again on Main Street.
You're welcome, Craig. Thank you.
Madeline reviews a movie, has to do with law enforcement a little bit. Long Legs. That's next. Stay with us.
Listening to Prairie Public right now, so I bet you're a bit of a news junkie, right? But do you also like music? Well, I bet you do. Prairie Public is the place for that too. Did you know that we have a guy named Mike Olson who spends adult album alternative music during the week?
There goes the last DJ who plays what he wants to play.
He's got an endless library, limitless musical knowledge, and a clever way of handcrafting sets of songs. You can listen to Prairie Public's Roots Rock and Jazz stream on an app or smart speaker pretty much anywhere, and on an HD radio anywhere in the region. Check out Mike Olson on Prairie Public weekdays from 9 a.m. to 10 and noon to 6 p.m.
And there's the fanfare. We welcome back to the Main Street Studios, Matt Olean. Matt, how's your summer going?
Good, Craig.
Is it scary being a lady FBI agent?
Yeah.
Take a nice long look. The letter was left with the bodies. Signed with one word.
Wonderful.
Matt, this one sounds like it's pretty scary. Slasher movie we have here. The movie, of course, is Long Legs.
It is scary. It's well done. Yeah, I'm on a slasher kick. We saw Maxine last week, and this is, I think, probably better than Maxine even, which I liked. And this is stylish. It's interesting. I would call this a mashup of Silence of the Lambs meets slasher meets satanic cult movie. So you got three different kind of genres all kind of in one. It's Silence of the Lambs because Micah Monroe plays this FBI agent, Lee Harker, and she's trying to solve 20-plus years of murders.
Gruesome murders.
Gruesome by this serial killer. You know, they're trying to figure out how this happens because the murders happen, Craig, without the murderer in the house. The person that they suspect, who is Long Legs, you know, played by Nicolas Cage. And he's never in the house. So how is this happening? How is this done? That's the big secret. When you go see the movie, of course, we're not going to reveal that. But it takes place in the 1990s up in Portland. There are flashbacks to the 1970s where this little girl meets Long Legs at a farmhouse. Harker's mother, played by Alicia Witt, is a key character in this movie as well. She still lives on that farm. Micah Monroe, kind of a scream queen actress, very good in this part. Blair Underwood plays her older FBI agent, boss, supervisor. They're trying to piece this together. Now, Lee Harker also has kind of supernatural powers. She can kind of sense things that are happening. She's piecing together these clues as to who is doing the killing and how they're going to find this serial killer and trap them. But as she gets further into it, our sense of audience dread, you know, kind of continues to grow. And I would say this, Craig, in a movie like this, when we feel powerless watching the movie, it's very creepy. And I think the audience will feel powerless. Like what supernatural things are going on that the Agent Harker has to figure out? Will she ever find the killer? If she does find the killer, will they be able to, you know, nab the killer? And there's this sense of dread, I think, that the writer-director Osgood Perkins, son of Anthony Perkins from Psycho fame, and he's done a really good job here. There's that sense of dread and kind of murky neighborhoods, grainy cinematography that hangs over this movie that I really liked. And I think it's probably the best horror movie I've seen so far this year. Nicolas Cage, who plays Longlegs, is terrifying, unrecognizable, terrifying with an incredible makeup job that they've got on him with long hair and makeup. And I'm going to go on record. I'm going to push him for a late career, not late career, he's only 60, he's won an Oscar, kind of a late career supporting actor nomination. Very tricky to get Oscar nominations from horror and slasher movies, as you know, Craig, but he's terrifying when he's on screen. And, you know, he's one of those characters, just like Lecter in Silence of the Lambs, that seems to be pulling the strings. He's controlling the strings, and you're not quite sure how he's controlling and pulling those strings, and that's what you have to find out. I like this one a lot. If you're scared of stuff like this, don't go. You're going to think about it afterwards, but it's stylish, well done, and I credit Osgood, they call him, Perkins, as the writer-director.
You talk about Nicolas Cage and his performance maybe being Oscar-worthy. Is the movie itself Oscar-worthy?
I don't think I would.
Is this one of those ones we're going to remember like Silence of the Lambs, Matt?
Silence of the Lambs is the exception to the rule with Oscars. It was, the only horror movie really to ever win Best Picture. I mean, it's possible. We don't know how 2024 is going to shake out. Is it going to be as strong and deep a year as 23 was? Doesn't look like it so far, but, we'll see. Sometimes with the current makeup of the Academy membership and voters, skewing younger now, it could slip in there. I really liked it, but it's making money. It's doing well at the box office. I think the word of mouth is good. The night I went, there were a lot of people there. I like horror slasher movies like this where there's kind of a slow build. It's not gore and slashing every 5 minutes. There's a build up to what's going on. There's an investigation. You follow Lee Harker as she investigates what's going on. Let me also tell you, there are creepy dolls in this movie too. There are dolls that these kind of handmade wooden dolls, dolls that look creepy.
Yeah.
Nothing scarier in movies, Craig, than dolls and little girl ghosts, right? Those are things that terrify us. So these dolls are creepy. They're important to the plot, very important to the plot. So keep an eye on these dolls when they pop up, when they find them and kind of piece things together. That's also crucial to the plot.
wasn't filmed in the basement of my neighbor's home in Riverton, was it, Matt? We would go downstairs and there were just these wonderful, wonderful older folks, great, great neighbors, two sisters and a brother. Our kids loved them, but she had an incredible doll collection downstairs that she loved. And I thought it was about the creepiest thing I'd ever
And you know they're just going to come alive at night, right? They're going to start looking at you, right?
I hope they never got into our home next door.
Anyway, I recommend Long Legs, one of the better movies I've seen this year.
All right, let's go on to our trivia question for the day, Matt. Of course, Nicolas Cage won the Oscar for his best actor role in Leaving Las Vegas at the 68th Academy Awards. Mm-hmm. Who won Best Actress that year, and also which picture won Best Picture?
Best Picture was Braveheart, the Mel Gibson movie, and Best Actress was Susan Sarandon for Dead Man Walking.
Your recollection is phenomenal, Matt. Thanks for joining us again on Main Street.
You bet.
More Main Streets ahead. Stay with us.
This is Dakota Daybook for July 25th. The rivalry between Grand Forks and Fargo was especially fierce in 1906. An agreement had been reached that the state fair would alternate between Grand Forks and Fargo, with Fargo scheduled to host the fair first. But there was some annoyance that Grand Forks was holding a Red River Valley Exposition just prior to Fargo's fair. In May of 1906, excitement rippled throughout North Dakota with the announcement of the date for exposition in Grand Forks, July 31st to August 3rd. Grand Forks business leaders predicted it would be the greatest of the kind ever held in the Northwest. The committee had set aside $15,000 for prize premiums and horse racing purses. The money was expected to attract the top competitors and the fastest horses. The Grand Forks newspaper highlighted the coming event. Throughout June, the Evening Times ran a banner across page tops calling attention to the exposition. Newspapers across the state picked up the story. Anticipation increased as further details were released. The premium list included almost 1,000 prizes. There were dozens of categories for everything from livestock and agriculture to arts, sewing, and baking. As the big day drew closer, businesses fueled the excitement by including the exposition in their ads, listing upcoming events. The announcement of very low railroad rates was sure to entice people from across the state to come. On this date, in 1906, with the big day right around the corner, the Evening Times ran the Red River Valley Exposition edition. Even rival Fargo had to grudgingly admit that the Grand Forks Exposition would be a big show. The exposition saw large crowds and garnered rave reviews, but not everyone was impressed. The Fargo newspaper printed a story that alcohol had been served. The paper described two blind pigs that were as wide open as any saloon could be. The exposition management denied the allegation. Fargo's subsequent state fair received positive, but rather lackluster reviews. Even the Fargo Forum had to admit that there were problems, and the fair suffered in comparison to the exposition in Grand Forks. The paper noted that better management would improve future fairs, going so far as to recommend the man who spearheaded the Red River Valley Exposition. Today's Dakota Daybook, written by Dr. Carol Butcher. I'm Ann Alquist.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding by Humanities North Dakota, North Dakota's largest lifelong learning community.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
And that's a wrap for today's Main Street. We are grateful that you have spent time with us today. Tomorrow at 3 p.m., we'll air The Middle with host Jeremy Hobson. This week's topic on the show, how does President Biden's exit and Vice President Harris's entrance as the de facto Democratic candidate change your view of the presidential race? And at 7 p.m., it's Science Friday with Ira Flatow. We hope you can join us again Monday here on Main Street.